For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. No,
that is... yes, that's something. That is quite a metaphor.
And the news is going to report
on it. Or analogy. Okay. We're talking about education, and I don't even know the difference this morning between a metaphor and an analogy. See,
I know.
It's See, seven, guys. Give me a minute.
You need to go back to school, Rachel.
Welcome to Rivera and Reeves, the podcast where we break through the bias, report the news, and occasionally trip over our soapboxes while ranting about the headlines.
Every week, we tackle the biggest stories with sharp analysis, unfiltered honesty, and just enough sarcasm to keep it fun.
So pull up a chair, grab your coffee, and join us as we wade through the spin, because the media is trash and we have zero patience for their nonsense. Hey, friends, and welcome to another episode of Rivera and Reeves. I'm Miss Sadie, and I'm here with my friend Rachel. Say hello, Rachel.
Hello, Rachel.
I like the tone there.
Yes.
And if this is your first time here, welcome. You have now found your new favorite podcast. And I would recommend that you give us a follow, 5-star rating, because you're going to love us anyway. So you might as well do it right now. And leave us a lovely review, because it helps the podcast grow. If you don't want to be listening to ads, there is a link in the show notes. Become a paying supporter, where you get ad-free episodes and bonus content and community over on our Substack. We are slowly growing. And for our new supporters, we are so grateful that you're here. And for our
longtime supporters...
We're grateful that you believed in us from the beginning.
I know. You guys are the best.
All right. So what are we talking about today? We're talking about a subject that I actually don't know a whole lot about. We're actually talking about a subject that I don't know a whole lot about, but Rachel has many strong opinions on.
I do. And surprise.
I know. And it's been a recent development in the news. Are you happy about the possible end of the Department of Education, or is that a little too much?
Well, there's a lot of people like myself that have been advocating for, at the very least, scaling back the power of the Department of Education, if not dismantling the entire agency, for a really long time. It's not like this is a popular take. Does it make you any friends? Mm-hmm. People don't even know where to start when you say that. And they kind of just think of you as like a nut when you say something like that. I mean, truly... If people aren't embedded in the education system in one way or another, either as a teacher, an administrator, a homeschooler, a parent of a student in any type of education, they're aghast when you say something like, I think the whole department should go. But there's a lot of us who have been saying it for a really long time. And so now it's happening and people are... astonished anew that you could say something like you want the Department of Education to go, because from an outsider perspective, all that says to someone is you want to hurt kids and you don't care about children. You don't care about education. But obviously, as we've learned from every topic in American politics and just America in general, there's much more to it than just
not caring and being heartless.
Yeah, the headline. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is typically...
what everybody goes with, and then they disengage from the conversation.
I've been accused of that one a few times. Well, we're going to be breaking down the recent news about the cuts at the Department of Education, which have created a lot of reaction. Some people are excited about it. Some people are upset about it. Some people think that this is the end. I would be surprised, because you can't just get rid of the Department of Education, because that would have to happen through Congress. You can't just be like, no more. You can weaken it significantly, but you can't just get rid of it. And then we're also going to give you an update on what's happening with Mahoub Khalid, which is the former Columbia student that has been the lead organizer of the protest at Columbia and Barnard, who is being detained and having his visa and green card revoked by the State Department. And then we have some kind of boring but interesting economy news.
Mm-hmm.
So
worth mentioning.
I always say it's kind of boring because I think it's worth mentioning, right?
I mean, the economy is one of those things that's boring, but really, really, really matters.
It affects everybody. So it's worth mentioning. Yeah. And we have another story that I'm going to see if we can get it. We can squeeze in here. Okay.
Cause yeah. Possible. And yeah, then we have Thursday segments. You know me. I love our extra bonus segments today. Two very fun questions. Hopefully we get to both of them. Probably we'll only get to one if we do the extra segment. So it just depends on whether we want to answer a fun question or talk about the past administration. I don't know what we're feeling today.
All right. So hold on, because you know how it is here. You got to hold on to your pantalones because you never know what's going to happen. Yes. All right. Department of Education. All right, ladies, let's talk about it. Especially full disclosure. And I don't have kids. So the Department of Education feedback for me, I'm just going to tell you what's going on. And Rachel's going to carry the conversation here on providing a little bit more context to it, especially as a homeschooling mother. But what happened recently? So we have a brand new Department of Education secretary, which is mm-hmm. Linda McMahon. And apparently she's going to wrestle the Department of Education into
submission. Oh, I see what you did there. She's going to wrestle it to the ground. If you don't understand, Miss Sadie, explain.
She is the ex-wife of, what was his name? Something McMahon.
Something McMahon.
Vince McMahon.
That's it.
Who was the creator, CEO, quasi pro wrestler of the WWE.
Okay, when I was a kid, it was the WWF.
Okay,
so
there we
if
go.
You're
I
like me,
remember.
And you were a child of the 80s, and you watched, I think we've talked about this on
it's
a past
WWE now. Okay,
yeah,
there we go.
But on yes. past campaign games episodes, we talked about weird things we did when we were 80s kids, and we would watch every Saturday morning WWF, and you all had mm-hmm. your favorite wrestler, and it was amazing. And Vince was, he was at more like the late ones, not.
Yeah, he
I was
wasn't
really,
there in the
young.
Beginning.
Yeah. Anyways, that is his ex-wife.
That was a, yeah. And that was, he's a whole problem, but we're not going to go into Vince McMahon. So Linda McMahon is, and she was CEO of the WWE for a long time. She was also the previous Trump's administration's Small Business Administration director, I think is mm-hmm. the position.
Something, bureau chief, I don't know.
Yeah. So she's been in the Trump
ethos
for a while. Okay. Cause mm-hmm. I don't know if you guys remember, but our president actually wrestled at the WWE one time.
I can believe it.
Did you know that?
Does not know, but it does not surprise me.
He did. He did like, there was like a whole storyline with him and yeah, it was.
Of course. Of course there was.
I didn't follow it, but cause I would never watched it, but I know of it as for a pulp culture reference.
Well, now I'm looking it up today. So thank you.
Really? Yeah. Anyways, so now she's come in and there has always been talk as to the goal for her that she was given by the president was essentially to return the Department of Education or dismantle our Department of Education so we can return education to the states. Employees received an email on Tuesday and then they were told not to come in to work on Wednesday.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people started to panic because obviously you get an email that tells you not to come into work on Wednesday. Immediately, there was a bunch of speculation that there was going to be cuts. Well, they were correct. So it turns mm-hmm. out that nearly 50% of the workforce of the Department of Education has been laid off. They had 4,133 to about 2,183, which is a layoff of 1,315 people.
And then some people took voluntary exits,
yes.
right?
Correct. So overall, that was a rough total of the 2,183 workers that either have been a portion of them laid off and a portion of them left.
Mm-hmm.
And then McMahon, of course, there's a lot of panic about this. The mm-hmm. NEA, which is the National Education Association, the president said that eliminating the department would be the equivalent of giving up on our future. So the mm-hmm. narrative there being that you're giving up on our kids, right?
Yeah.
Now, McMahon did an interview and she says.
Well, and the NEA is also a teachers union. They have
well,
a very
so,
vested
Well,
interest.
That was the other thing. Okay, so you have McMahon is kind of pointing out like, let me be clear. She said during the interview that I'm not trying to take away education.
Of course
We're
not.
Trying to put an end to the bureaucracy within Correct. Education.
Yeah. Clearly, we're not taking away education. The president never said that. He's taken the bureaucracy out of education so that more money flows to the states. Better education is closest to the kids, with parents, with local superintendents, with local school boards. I think we'll see our scores go up with our students when we can educate them with parental input as well.
Well, she's very angry. And over the weekend, I posted on X that it would be nice if Randy were ever angry about the abysmal eighth grade and fourth grade reading
and math.
Math proficiency. You see those numbers, like 18%, 22% of proficiency or above? In fourth and eighth grade, we rank near the bottom globally on these standards. Well, it's shocking, given how much we're putting up a graphic, given how much we spend. It's terrible.
I'll tell you, it's unbelievable. And when you think about high school seniors that are graduating, only 30% of them are reading proficiently. Now, that doesn't mean that they can't read words.
But hello.
They can't read cognitively. And that's what we're missing. You know, you read to learn up until third grade, and then after that, you're learning to read up until the end of third grade, then you're reading to learn. And if you can't read after the end of third grade, you're going to be behind in your reading. And so that's what we have to focus on.
Well, you know.
But then you had your BFF, mm-hmm. Randy Weingarten.
Ugh, yelling.
Yes. Where she has been particularly upset about the attack on education.
So we know, for example, what Texas would do.
Right.
They'll use it for vouchers. So they won't give it to the kids who have it now. They'll just give it for vouchers.
Catholic schools, religious schools.
And frankly, what we're seeing in all the programs that are now extant in terms of vouchers, they don't work for kids. They basically go right now. It becomes a tax credit for people who already are sending their kids to private schools.
Yeah, well, and when you have someone like Randy Weingarten, who is the president of one of the largest teachers unions in the country, making $500,000 a year, she has a vested interest in keeping that teachers union in power.
Of course.
Because that teachers union and other teachers unions have an outsized influence of what goes on in classrooms. And as you'll remember, I hope that Americans' memories aren't this short, but any parent who had their child in public schools during COVID owes Randy Weingarten no allegiance whatsoever after she lobbied to keep schools closed for the most unnecessary amount of time. And mm-hmm. and because of those closures, there was an outsized negative impact on children all across our country. And just to hear her sitting there crying and saying, I'm so mad. It's like, no, I feel zero for her. No sympathy whatsoever. Her policies and her outsized amount of power during COVID was arguably one of the most destructive voices during that time. People keep griping about Fauci, rightfully so, and she's next on the list. When I hear her so upset, I'm like, meh, miss me.
You don't feel really bad
nope,
for her.
Not at all. Zero.
So
feelings.
I was gonna ask, so now we have, that is the current status of the Department of Education. Mm-hmm. And as I've said in the past, and I shared a post about this, mm-hmm. the Department of Education, the administration can't just get rid of it. Like it has to go through legislation. And the process or the way it came about, like a lot of people kind of get used to things existing. And so mm-hmm. you almost think like they've been there forever. But the Department of Education is as old as I am.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not, I mean,
so young.
You're like, we're still so young. There's always been there's this idea that for as long as there's been education in our country, there's been a Department of Education. And so lots of advocates for the Department of Education will always say that. But that's completely disingenuous. The level and scope to which the federal government has a say in state education is relatively new. It was started under Jimmy Carter.
Pet project to
yeah, try I don't like to speak ill of the dead, but it was a total ego trip, to start a new agency like that when one arguably was not needed. Yes, the Department of Education was signed under Andrew Johnson in 1867, but there was a totally different purpose. That was to collect statistics about what was going on in the nation's schools. And as the country grew, it was called the Office of Education. The Office of Education would be transferred to like the federal security agency or the Department of Health.
He else would manage it.
Yes. So it wasn't until Jimmy Carter in 1979 and then implemented in 1980 that the Department of Education Act like established it as a modern cabinet level Department of Education. And then it started in 1980 and it just ballooned since then. And it's never stopped ballooning. In 1980, it started with $14.2 billion. Which still, but, and then now in 2024, $268 billion. It's like a, something like a 460% increase since that time.
And which that, is way more than inflation. So if anybody's trying to claim that that's inflation, it's
well, yep. Well, and that also far, far, far outpaces the increase in student population. Student population's only grown about 9% in that time, but you have a 460% increase to money or to the funds being allocated. Yeah. So it's just, it's bloat. Now, like you said, it's bloat. It's a bureaucratic agency. That is what it has become. And that was not, I believe, the initial intent, obviously, of when the Office of Education began. And I don't even know if it was necessarily Jimmy Carter's dream for the agency either. But like you said, in America, when we start something.
Yeah, it just. It keeps getting bigger. And it makes sense that Carter did it. Do you know what I mean? Like the yeah. one of the tenets or one of the big goals, especially during that period of politics or ever since the 60s, was to provide education for everybody. You know what I mean? Right. Like the free education kind of idea. And yeah. this is kind of, I mean, obviously you don't end up with free education per se because we're all paying taxes. Mm-hmm. But that's the argument and that's ultimately the goal. But yeah. I believe one of the issues has been the standardized testing and the way the department kind of like, I don't know if it if it's influence or regulates education mm-hmm. from the top down that, I mean, consistently, the more money we continue to spend on students, the worse mm-hmm. our students are doing. I just heard a statistic that not only is it that our reading and mathematic levels are stupid low, but there yeah. apparently is a huge truancy issue too. It's like a 30% issue that and has been increasing. And so yes.
there's reading performance problems. There's mathematical performance problems. I mean, I could talk to you for hours about those. So we all just understand that we haven't just plateaued over the past since the 1970s. We are consistently at a like stubbornly low percentage. Only there are so many statistics, but one I'll leave you with that is just alarming, quite honestly. Only about this isn't just like something I pulled out of the sky. According to the nation's report card, which is called the NAEP, that does like a longitudinal study of American students every couple of years, and between the 1970s and the 2000s, it's stagnated, like our growth as far as reading performance and mathematics performance. But this, I can't stop thinking about this. Approximately 37% of fourth graders and 34% of eighth graders read at proficient levels. That means that over half of our country's children are essentially illiterate. They're unable to read even at grade level. And
it's not just the reading, but I'm assuming it's the comprehension.
Well, it's comprehension, it's reading, it's mathematics. As of 2 years ago, only 26% of eighth graders are proficient in math, because with the nation's report card, they test fourth grade and eighth grade and to get kind of like an idea across the board, middle school and moving into or elementary and moving into middle school. And then you're able to kind of get this idea from these tests that consistently year after year after year since the education department began, our scores have not only stagnated, but some have declined. And that is with this huge growth of money being pumped into the schools. And like you said, there's issues with truancy. Civics is no longer being taught in schools. In some national testing, it shows that the historical understanding of our country is at an all-time low. Kids aren't How could they learn history when they're not even having enough time to learn adequate mathematics and reading? College readiness, approximately 40% of first-year college students require remedial coursework in English and mathematics. That means kids are going into college being told, we're going to pass you, we're going to graduate you from high school, while they're still not even ready to enter
like college-level courses. Yeah. With all of this going on and this new announcement of the cuts in the administration, and obviously this new administration's goal is to, if they can't get rid of it, is to significantly make it smaller and honestly, I guess, diminish its power or its influence.
Yeah. Right.
What do you see is going to happen? What happens with the money that the Department of Education gets? Let's say if they don't become completely dismantled, like how do you see the future, and what are some of the most common, because I know this is the kind of content that you share on your platform. So what is the most common question that you get that is from either fear or misunderstanding of exactly what is happening?
Yeah, well, a lot of the money, I think, too, people need to understand, just because the Department of Education allocates money doesn't mean that if the Department of Education, it would depend on how, first of all, let's put it out there. I don't believe that the Department of Education will be abolished by Congress. I don't think that that is, well, right now, I don't think it would be able to happen. I'm not even sure if every Republican has an appetite to do that. Yeah. I don't know if they think that their constituents, even their Republican constituents, have an appetite for that. So let's just put that out there. Even if the Department of Education was, quote unquote, abolished by Congress, if they did decide to abolish it, there would have to be some rewriting of where the funds would go and how they would be dispersed. And that's something that's high level. I don't even necessarily know exactly what they would do. They would probably try and transfer the funds to different agencies for disbursement. For instance, people are very upset about some of the programs for low income or children with disabilities who have like IEPs and 504s. Those are programs that provide federal accommodations for students that have learning challenges. But then there's also programs like Title I and IDEA, that IDEA, that they could transfer to other agencies like Health and Human Services, NIH. They could, there could be all kinds of different other agencies that handle the disbursement of different funds. Also, the Department of Education handles lots of Pell Grants. They handle the school lunch programs. And lots of people are like, well, that's all going to disappear. And no, not necessarily. Those funds can be allocated and dispersed from other agencies as well. Or if they were to dismantle slash abolish the Department of Education, there could be other ways to disperse federal funds allocated for those things, like block grants to the different states. There's different options. So to just say, if the Department of Education is dismantled, all of those things cease to exist, it's not true. Programs like Title I and IDEA, those are separate pieces of law. Those would also have to be abolished by an act of Congress. And Congress is not going to, I don't think there is an appetite for any congressional member to be like, you know what? You know what sounds good? You know what's going to get me reelected? Taking away the rights afforded to children who have learning challenges. That sounds like what I'm going to run on. So I think people need to take a step back and actually assess what the Department of Education actually allocates. They allocate a lot of money for Pell Grants and federal loan programs, which I have a huge issue with and don't love them being taking my tax dollars to offer loans to other people. Especially,
I think they should be private, and that happened during
Obama.
Absolutely.
So. And look at what's coming out of some of our colleges. I don't want to be paying for that. I don't want to be paying for any of that. But then they're looking at things like school lunches. That's a huge sticking point for a lot of people. But again, the school lunch programs, those can be allocated. The funds can be sent and dispersed from different agencies. That could be an option. Money could be sent in a block grant to states, and they could handle their school lunch programs, which, by the way, many, many, many of the people I'm hearing complain that school lunches are going to disappear are also the people who are saying school lunches are absolute trash. They're awful for these students. And because they are run by a federal bureaucracy, there's no way of revamping them and making them better for students.
I think that's one of the challenges here with, like, the goal for at least for myself, who doesn't have children. So I don't really have like skin in the game, but
except for you're paying for a bunch of this,
except for the yeah, except for the taxes that I'm paying for. But my what I would love to see, because again, my priority is for people to have a voice and for, you know, mm-hmm. liberty in general. Yeah. And so for these funds, if they are reallocated, that they're allocated to the state where the state Correct. Can better know and handle mm-hmm. how to feed children, what programs they need, what are the actual necessities at the state level, which then also Right. permits the state actually, I prefer it would even go smaller. Like, I think it should be like the federal gives it to the state and then the state goes
state
and gives
it to local communities.
To local, Absolutely. Yeah, communities. And then the communities are able to have a larger voice on how stuff is managed versus not knowing where it's coming from because it's coming from the top level that doesn't really – it really diminishes your capability to have a voice in how your children are being educated, fed, and services provided – for you personally at the state level.
Of course. And to assume that a federal agency has any knowledge of how all students across the country learn well is just absurd.
Well, and the needs for a student in rural Louisiana is very different
yes. in upstate New York. Yes.
Or LA or something like, or Montana right. or whatever.
Well, and how they need to be fed, what kinds of things that their school actually need. Those are decisions that need to be exclusively made by local communities. And I will, for the life of me, never understand why people believe and desire a federal agency must exist. Like, it's imperative for it to be there in order for their school to thrive. That is not...
Well, what do you say to people who are in a state where it's already kind of like crud education? Mm-hmm. And so they view that this is just going to make it even worse. Like, they don't have any hope. They don't really hope that getting rid of the Department of Education is actually going to improve things at the state level when the state is already not doing well to begin with, because every state does differently. Now, right. I know that United States as a whole is mm-hmm. not doing well in comparison to other like major functioning Western countries.
Yeah.
But, you know, when we're
like 38th in the world.
Yeah.
It's sad.
But when we're like talking here just within the United States, like mm-hmm. if you are in a state that does not have a strong education system,
I would ask them how the Department of Education has improved their education system in the last 50 years. It hasn't done them any state or local community whose schools are in decline have not been benefited by the Department of Education on a scale worth measuring. Mm-hmm. I would love to see those schools constantly. Schools that suffer and are struggling have been doing so and continue to do so. The Department of Education doesn't come in and rescue those schools. It just doesn't. And I don't think it's their job, first of all, because they don't know the unique situations of every single, there's not enough employees in the federal government to be able to handle all the different communities and towns throughout our country and solve their unique problems. That is a local issue. That is an issue where, like you said, adults, parents, grandparents, local politicians need to use their voice to advocate for better education and resources for their students. And there's nothing, the Department of Education doesn't help with that anyways. If anything, I've spoke with so many administrators and teachers who have said the hurdles that they have to jump through with the Department of Education only make their job worse. It makes it harder for them to actually do the things that they need to do inside their classrooms. And if somebody's saying, well, I live in a failing area, my schools are struggling, the answer is not the Department of Education. It just isn't. There needs to be
the answer would be more power given to the state so you have, or your district, so you have more say on what
yeah,
is happening.
I think locally driven approaches will achieve much superior results than the Department of Education. And there are like other examples of that. There has to be like charter school autonomy. There needs to be like local vocational education models. There needs to be rural innovation, parent choice programs, all these things that locally you can do within your state. I just think we've been lulled into this kind of pseudo trans where we think that if there's a problem in our state, that the federal government's going to come in and fix it. And so often they fail at doing that. And if it's an issue of education, there's no spokesperson better than a parent to come in and go, I identify these problems within my district. How are we going to fix it? And guaranteed, 99% of the time, it is not going to be a federal solution. It's going to be a local one. And so I have a hard time with the whole, we need the federal government for failing schools. Are you kidding? Our schools are failing now more than ever. And the federal government doesn't come in and clean it up.
Yeah. And what is it that, because, you know, if you were to reallocate programs like lunches, children with special needs to other departments, what is left for the Department of Education to influencing? Well, I guess what I'm trying to get is, if you get rid of the Department of Education, and but then everything, they do all of these things, and then it just goes ahead and gets reallocated to other still federal departments, you can essentially argue that the department is still existing. It's just existing in a more fractured form. So I'm wondering, like, obviously we want to be able to provide aid to children that are most in need and don't have resources for themselves at the local level, either because their parent isn't involved or they're they don't have a parent. But then what is it that the Department of Education is doing that influences a school to the level where they can't effectively improve? Is it because of standardized testing? Is it because of guidelines that come from the Department of Education in regards to education itself, which affects the entire student body? Do you know what I mean? That then makes it more difficult for, at the state level, for them to improve if they're not. Now they can be like, I don't want your federal money. We're just going to go and do our own thing, because that's typically what it is. It's like, you have to follow, I don't know, XYZ in order to get federal funds. So that's why the schools will have to do whatever it is that's required by the Department of Education. I mean, am I correct in that kind of?
Yeah, you're correct. I think there are not tons and tons of things that the Department of Education does that other departments couldn't take on successfully and maybe even narrow the scope and do it more efficiently. So like a school lunch program, instead of just throwing money at states and saying, these are the guidelines, you need to follow these, this is how much food, depending on the food pyramid, this is what you need to provide, giving them very little resources and understanding of what they're doing, that could be handled by a different agency and in a much better way. So if you just like outline what is it that the Department of Education does, and is there anything that they uniquely do that they only understand, I think that it would come down to the problem with the Department of Education that a lot of advocates seem to think is necessary is oversight of students' test scores. They want to have this standardized understanding of where students are. So there's a lot of pressure on teachers and schools with standardized tests every single year. And they want to know who's in schools. They want to know what the kids are doing, who they are, where are they. And so it's a lot of just federal oversight. And so there's not, I have yet to learn about something that the Department of Education handles that can't be outsourced to another agency or
left
sent back to the
states.
And I don't, honestly, I don't understand why more states wouldn't want it, wouldn't want the power to make decisions that are best for their state. There's a lot of oversight and decision-making being made in D.C. for schools all over the country that is unnecessary, in my opinion. You know,
well, and we've seen it historically during the Obama administration. Michelle's whole thing was like to make food better for people. And then it went viral, or for students. And then it went viral, the whole like, thanks, Obama, or thanks, Michelle, or whatever, because the food was horrendous. You know what I mean? Because it had certain requirements. But then also there was a restricted budget. And so you just ended up with just, I don't know, like with pizza and chocolate milk. You know what I mean?
And that's now standard. And you have these people who are completely out of touch with the needs of children, who are making like dietary decisions for schools in Arkansas, who live in DC and have no concept of either children nor what they need nor what the school can access based on where they live, their food options there. And then, of course, with every administration, you have new programs being added to what the Department of Education is already doing. You had the No Child Left Behind.
Yeah.
With George W. that added. Well, yeah. No Child Left Behind left added $80 billion in federal funds to what they already were doing. And it was saying we need like to have 100% student proficiency, closure of achievement gaps. But then the results were like no single state achieved those proficiency targets at all. It was a failure, abject failure. And then you get under Obama, you get the Race to the Top, which added like $4.5 billion in competitive grants. And there was, according to the Department of Education in 2016, there was no actual significant impact. There's just so many, they just keep adding. We've talked about this in other episodes. The administration, not the administration, but the U.S. government, the federal government is great at adding new programs and new ideas.
And not subtracting.
And new cost spending things. And they're very, very bad at taking things away that do not work. And I understand that it is hard for people to hear about something being subtracted that has to do with education. But I wish people would look at it just a little bit holistically, that it's not subtracting things from education. It's doing a cost-benefit analysis over the past 55 years and realizing that the department has not done anything, very few things positive for students and families, and has cost us billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars. And we continue to hit our head against the wall and be like, why does it hurt? And instead of looking at as taking away something from children, I wish people could, or I encourage people to start looking at it as possibly.
Well, it's efficiency. It's again, like trying to make it more efficient. Well, and I think, this was something I was talking about with someone else. It's not that people want to cut just for the sake of cutting because they don't care and they want to put more money in their pocket because they're greedy. The problem here is that when you have waste, when you aren't efficient, you are wasting money that is would probably better benefit people that actually really you would be able to support more people that really need help without having to print money, which then causes a negative effect overall on the economy. It makes our dollar weak. It causes inflation. So that's like a negative effect on the population as a whole.
Yes.
And then also at the same time, you still don't have enough efficiency or funds, or it's just like a mess in order to help the people who really, really need children with special needs. I don't know, a child in the foster care system. Like all it's like, it's not like I don't care. Like I'm not a psychopath.
Right. Well, and I would say that most people care what kind of education we are providing for our nation's youth. It directly impacts our population, our populace, and how we react and adapt and move through the world. It's important that our children are learning the basics, but they're not. They're not learning math. They're not learning reading. They're not learning civics, which, again,
which to me is wild.
It is wild, but look at what's happening around our country right now. There is a fundamental misunderstanding of so many things that were basics that you were taught 50, 60, 70 years ago in our school systems about the structure of our government and why it exists and what it does for us and what we need to then in turn do for it. That is gone. There's a basic lack of understanding about our country's history, world history. And so I want quality education for all children in our country. The problem is we're not offering that to them.
Yeah.
And we have a Department of Education that exists to uphold itself. And I'm sure there are well-intentioned people who are maybe working in that department. And there's great teachers and there's great administrators all over the country. And I guarantee, because I hear from them, there are many teachers and administrators who would be very glad to have the Department of Education out of their lives so they can get on with the business of running
and actually teaching
schools
for
their children. Yes. And since you and I love to discuss the rights of our country and what is in or the rights of the citizens and what is in our founding documents, the fact is that the Department of Education is unconstitutional.
What's the argument? Okay. Because
the Department of Education was never like an enumerated right within our Constitution. It's harder to subtract a program than to add one. We talk about that all the time. But there's an absence of it completely in the Constitution. So the Constitution never like explicitly mentions education as a federal responsibility. It's just It doesn't. It basically is suggesting.
I mean, but you can make an argument. There's a bunch of stuff, especially at the administrative level,
right?
That was not. It's within the executive's branch and how they manage the government. To honestly, if I were to say anything, it's unconstitutional because the creation of departments. I guess you can make an argument should be left up to the executive branch. They should have complete control of those administrative departments because they're under the executive branch.
Right.
Although, obviously, it is Congress that has control of the purse. Yes.
So, like, that would be argued as, like, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution enumerates specific powers granted to Congress of, like, what they can do. And education is not included in that. And basically, what I think the argument would be is that, according to the 10th Commandment, I think those should be in school, too. What do you say about that? It's not a federal responsibility. And so it historically in our country, education was always considered a local matter rather than a federal responsibility.
And like a hyper local matter.
Yeah. And I mean, a lot of people, critics of the Department of Education, would say that basically it infringes on the principle of federalism.
That's the case in general. One of the biggest issues is that we have two mindsets, especially here in the United States, especially when it comes to Democrat versus Republican for the most part, where there's a discussion of like, you're taking away my rights or that's my right. But then it's the idea of the positive and negative rights. It's like the rights that you just are inherently born with that do not require the action, labor
of someone else.
Or participation of somebody else, which are positive rights, which is typically what you would hear from a Democrat. I have a right to health care. I have a right to insurance. I have a right to housing. However, all of those, quote, rights require the work, labor, and regulation of another individual versus a negative right, which means you don't have to do anything. They just literally exist.
Well, and I think that's the hardest part. People don't like to say hard things out loud. Because then you have to solve problems. You have to kind of like work around it. But like you said, we're not expressly offered the right to education because that depends on the labor of someone else. So that's hard for people because what you'll hear in this conversation are a lot of just pithy kind of feel-good statements like every child deserves a quality education. It's the right of every child. Well, I believe that every child deserves a quality education. I want every child to have a quality education. But is that their right? And because is it your right? Because when it becomes a right of a child or of a family to have the right to send their child to school, then that then requires someone else's labor. And then how are we going to fund that labor? And so you see what
I mean? Well, and how are you going to regulate it, too? Because at some point.
Well, and all the federal government wants to do so far, as long as I've been a parent, is they want to regulate. They want to know everything. Even as a homeschooler, they want in my business all the time. And that's what the federal government is great at. They're great at regulating. They're great at telling you how they're going to be basically watching you. And they want that regulatory power. And they have it. And if the Department of Education is gone, that regulatory power is passed back to the states. And that gets real uncomfortable for the federal government so far. And so I like it that the Trump administration is saying, we don't need it. We don't deserve it. States should be taking care of states' issues. And the education of children belongs at the state issue. This is not a federal problem to be solved. This is a state's issue to be solved.
And that's a lot of what's coming out of this administration, which.
Yes. It's a fundamental different understanding of our country. And I know it's difficult for people because we have a huge federal government. And all of us have become very used to living in a country where the federal government
is ginormous.
Has an outsized influence in our life. But that is not how it was meant to be. And many of the issues that we depend on the federal government to solve, because we act like it's too big for states to solve, it's backwards. Our states, that's why we move into different states. That's why people for so long selected different states to live in, because there was unique solutions in those states to problems they had, or they appreciated how their state voted on something or how their state handled a certain issue. And that's really, really important for us to understand. The federal government, at least my understanding of the founding, it was never meant to be this big. And yes, now we have a booming population that wasn't a problem back then. But I still think the undergirdings of
Yeah, but I think that can still be handled at the state level because every state can adjust for their own population. So
correct. I think it's just a fundamental difference of opinion on how our country is supposed to run.
Well, and I've always said the issue with the whatever housing is a right, food is, you know, all these kind of things is that, and again, it's like because of the regulations that is required and the oversight that is required to do that, you're fundamentally limiting the liberty of individuals.
Yeah, and like you're putting the burden
like a byproduct of it.
Yeah, you're putting the burden of the right on someone else. I deserve all these things, but who is going to provide them for me? They're not necessarily
who's
going to
determine how much I get? Because then at some point, it's this other body that determines and regulates how much you're going to get, how worthy you are of it, whether you qualify for it.
Yep.
And I understand, I absolutely understand that there are individuals that there needs to be like a safety net for the individuals who legitimately come on hard times, have nothing of no fault of their own. I think that should be done much more at like the community level.
Correct.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Church, your neighborhood, your town at a very hyper-focused level. But I'm not like opposed to maybe increasing that up to the state level. But I don't, it starts messing with, and that's where my like, you know how I'm like, I'm conservative with libertarians and like, that's where my libertarian comes in. It's do not tell me.
Don't tell me what to do.
I totally agree.
What I
can
have or what I can't, you know what I mean? It just drives me nuts.
There's so much more to talk about. If you guys have more questions or you want to go more in depth, I wrote an article. We'll put it in the show notes about the Department of Education. And it's public. It's in front of the paywall, open for everybody. Share it. And hopefully it's helpful.
And this will clearly continue to be something that's going to be discussed, obviously, because this administration is like doing a fundamental shift. And so anything it does, it lifts his leg and farts in the wind. And it
that is... Yes, that's something. That is quite a metaphor.
And the news is going to report
on it. Or analogy. Okay. We're talking about education, and I don't even know the difference this morning between a metaphor and an analogy. See, it's,
I know.
It's See, seven, guys. Back, give me a minute.
You need to go back to school, back to Rachel. School.
Let's go ahead and wrap up a few other things that are going on. I want to give you guys an update on what's going on with the Mahmoud Khalil. Okay. What's going on with him? Yesterday, there was a hearing for him. There's a huge debate going on right now. There's
I haven't heard about this at all. What's been going on?
Nobody's talking about this, right?
No one, not anyone.
We already covered and gave you guys the background on what is going on in the last episode. So if you want to get more background information, it's in the last episode. Most recently, there's a big debate going on about, is this freedom of speech? And does the State Department have a right to revoke his green card and his student visa? Mm-hmm. Also, by the way, I just saw his timeline. He got a student visa and a green card pretty fast.
Yeah, real quick. And didn't he marry? He found and married
And then
his
he
wife
also
with,
he
very quickly.
Married a U.S. citizen, too. Mm-hmm. I'm just
saying. Muy rápido. Do you like it? I'm bringing my Spanish every day to impress my Puerto Rican pal here. She's never impressed, but she does laugh every time.
It is quite entertaining. But he's been set for deportation. A court out of New York, the Southern District of New York, blocked his deportation. He's currently being held in Louisiana.
Why is he in Louisiana?
I don't know. Like,
is that where
probably,
they live?
Honestly,
you would just fly out to New York to protest?
My guess is that because it's ICE and it's like you have more broad jurisdiction.
Yeah.
And so if you're going to be going through the legal process, you probably prefer to be in Louisiana than New York.
Yeah. But I thought that was the whole issue that the judge had was that she wasn't sure I don't remember if it's a male or female, was nervous about the jurisdiction issue. Like,
And that's one of the things that's being argued by his attorneys. I mean, there was an argument about whether or not appropriate jurisdiction, the attorneys wanted to contact him, but the hearing didn't have anything to do with his deportation. It was all procedural in the sense of like, yes, his attorneys can speak with him and everything else. It was kind of like, I need to review it more. So it's kind of like still like a wait and see. Like there was no huge developments about it. Now he still has to go through the administrative judge that does the, oh my gosh, what is it? Like immigration judge, which like I said before, it's under the executive branch. It's not under the judicial branch. So it is administrative. He still has to go that. Now, everything that I'm researching so far is that the major issue here is that the State Department has very broad say and a very basic, limited burden of proof. Like the burden of proof is clear and convincing evidence. So it's not like beyond a reasonable doubt. It's just it has to be like, yeah, I think this guy is a likely threat to the United States. And therefore, the State Department has a right to deport them. Deportability.
Yeah, they have much like their plenary power over immigrants, over immigration in general, is a lot different than their plenary power over like citizens who are actual U.S. citizens in the country. It's the balance like is more in favor for the executive branch with non-citizens, and much more the balance is more in favor of free speech when it comes to citizens. That needs to be understood. It's not the same. We don't have the same rights, and definitely the executive branch has more say in what is acceptable and not acceptable for non-citizens.
Well, and specifically, the biggest thing is that a lot of people are like, well, he hasn't been charged with anything, or he hasn't been arrested with anything.
He doesn't need to be.
He doesn't have to be. Now, you may not like that. I think that's kind of weird, okay? I feel like you should be charged with something. I feel like you should be like going through some type of, I don't know, due process, which he will eventually go through a due process. Mm-hmm. But it's not like, you know, here in the United States where it's as a U.S. citizen, you have certain, what is it? They read you your rights, the Miranda rights, or that they have to have probable cause or anything like that. It's literally like ICE can detain you. They can hold you. They're the law enforcement. And then the State Department is the one that can determine whether they're going to revoke your green card. And they have very broad say on whether or not they can revoke your green card. You can like that. You cannot like that. But that
but is people have been deported throughout the history of America.
Yeah, this has been a
they
long time.
They have been deported for just having membership in a pro-terrorist group, in a pro-terrorist organization. So I don't have a problem with that. If you like, we can argue our feelings about that, but this isn't new. And you're going to hear a lot of people, especially on the side of Mahmoud Khalil, saying this is unprecedented. No, it is not. It's not unprecedented. These things have happened before. I actually looked it up. In 1999, there was Reno versus American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. So that was when several Palestinian immigrants with green cards were deported for their alleged support of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a group labeled as a terrorist organization. In 1952, there was a lawful permanent resident. It doesn't say a U.S. citizen, so he probably had, like you said, a green card. Yeah. He was deported under the Alien Registration Act of 1940 for his membership in the Communist Party, which the government viewed as advocating the overthrow of the U.S. government. So this isn't like when they come out and they say this has never happened before. Well, no, that's not true. It has happened. And the State Department deports people all the time for having terrorist ties. You can feel.
Well, and then like here's the other challenge is that so he went, he's not a student anymore, by the way. He graduated.
He graduated.
He's just here on a green card and he's still in university housing. Now, he led the organization. He was the spokesperson. He was the negotiator for the organization that was leading the protests that took over buildings, caused damage, encampments, blocked people from going to class. Those things are specifically in the legislation considered are illegal. It's like,
well, they're in violation of the act, the Immigration Act that we're falling back on.
Not only that, but it's for example, there's two of them that a lot of people are citing. There's like 18 USC 245B, okay? So this is protecting rights. This is hate crimes type of stuff, or this is, which I hate that, but it's more along the lines of discrimination, for example. Mm-hmm. So like you can't block people because of their religion or because of their race, nationality, or anything from attending school, going to work, or voting, for example.
All the things that they did.
Which is what they did. They were blocking Jewish students who are Israeli students from going to class and from having access to their education merely because they were either Israeli or Jewish. That's a problem. The other is there's another law, and it's about the deportation. It says this immigration, and this is like a this is a quick summary for layman's people. This immigration law lets the U.S. deport someone who isn't a citizen, like someone with a green card, if they are seen as a danger to national security, especially if they're linked to terrorism. And that is up to the discretion of the State Department.
Yes, this is not hard. And sorry, go ahead. I want to interrupt.
Well, and then the thing is that he led an organization, which is the Columbia University Apartheid Divest Organization. Mm-hmm. That was the organization that he was leading. And that is also the organization that a lot of the attorneys that are representing him are being supported by. And this particular organization is talking about being militant, being supportive of, like, I can't even express the things that were coming out of official statements from this organization.
Correct.
Like, our intifada is an internationalist one, as in, like, they want to take it all over the place. They want to take down Western ideals and the Western way of life. These are statements that are, and I actually shared this in my stories. This is a statement from that organization. Now, the challenge is that if you are part of this organization and you are a U.S. citizen, you can't be deported. Your process
is
different.
First Amendment rights, yes. But he is not protected under that. I mean, the movement that he started, I know you shared stuff yesterday. I shared stuff. They are saying things that directly violate this law. And what I said in my stories yesterday is you cannot like that law. So go advocate for legislation to be rewritten to change it. But as it stands, this law exists. He's in violation of it. And the State Department has the ability to deport him. It is as simple as that. He does not deserve the same First Amendment rights that you and I do as U.S. citizens.
Well, and here's the other thing. If he was just, let's say he was leading this group and it was just that statement and that's their statement and they were peacefully protesting and they were speaking out about it and they were sharing their opinion and they were organizing and passing out pamphlets and educating people about their position, that would be one thing. I don't have to like that. I can be disgusted by their messaging because I am. But that would fall within the realms of freedom of speech. Now, still, the State Department could make an argument that could still make an argument and make that threat. You know what I mean? But it would probably be a whole lot stickier because it is legitimately it's all about speech. But that is not all he did. All he also organized a group that was harassing students, that was causing damage, that was, I would argue, coercing and threatening the school administration.
Oh, for sure. He was the mediator between the students and the faculty.
And I think mediator is a very loose term.
They were making demands. That's essentially what they were doing.
Because he was basically like, you will do what we want you to do, or these protests and these occupations and byproduct, the damage to the university and the lack of the students being able to go to class will continue. That's blackmail.
Yeah. Well, it is. And I think, again, facts matter and they hurt people's feelings because it doesn't align with what they want to see happen. But when you apply for a green card on the application form, it says, have you ever advocated the overthrow of a government by force or violence? And of course, all of these people will be like, no, we weren't doing that. We're just fighting for the end of a genocide in Gaza. But explicitly, time after time, caught on video, these protesters and Khalil were parroting things like, we support liberation by any means necessary, including armed resistance. They called for like a total eradication of Western civilization. Be honest. There's multiple videos of him. I posted one yesterday. He's wearing a sweatshirt with a picture of someone in a keffiyeh wearing a Hamas headband. And they're chanting in the streets as they're guiding the pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel contingent down the streets, yelling, Allah Akbar, O Muslim. Or Muslim, and saying to cut off the heads of Zionists. There's another video of him where he's standing in front of a crowd of thousands of people and he's calling for them to celebrate Hamas terrorism. And these are the terrorists who slaughtered civilians.
Like,
so,
if he had been asked these questions during a different administration,
they would have been like, no, you're not coming in. Exactly. No green card for you. No green card for you. I understand
Marco
that hurts people's feelings, but
Rubio literally discussed this. He was asked about this while where is he? I think he was still in Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia.
I don't remember. But he was asked about this and he pretty much laid it out. And that is exactly the case that he made. He was like, if you had said X, Y, and Z before I gave you the green card,
no green card,
you would not have gotten it.
No.
And therefore you shouldn't be getting it or you shouldn't have it now.
And you got to go.
When you come to the United States as a visitor, which is what a visa is, which is how this individual entered this country, on a visitor's visa, okay, you are here as a visitor. We can deny you that visa. We can deny you that if you tell us when you apply, hi, I'm trying to get into the United States on a student visa. I am a big supporter of Hamas, a murderous, barbaric group that kidnaps children, that rapes teenage girls, that takes hostages, that allows them to die in captivity, that returns more bodies than live hostages. If you tell us that you are in favor of a group like this, and if you tell us when you apply for your visa, and by the way, I intend to come to your country as a student and rile up all kinds of anti-Jewish student, anti-Semitic activities. I intend to shut down your universities. If you told us all these things when you applied for a visa, we would deny your visa. I hope we would. If you actually end up doing that, once you're in this country on such a visa, we will revoke it. And if you end up having a green card, not citizenship, but a green card as a result of that visa while you're here in those activities, we're going to kick you out. It's as simple as that. This is not about free speech. This is about people that don't have a right to be in the United States to begin with. No one has a right to a student visa. No one has a right to a green card, by the way. So when you apply for a student visa or any visa to enter the United States, we have a right to deny you for virtually any reason. But I think being a supporter of Hamas and coming into our universities and turning them upside down and being complicit in what are clearly crimes of vandalization, complicit in shutting down learning institutions. There are kids at these schools that can't go to class. You pay all this money to these high-priced schools that are supposed to be of great esteem, and you can't even go to class. You're afraid to go to class because these lunatics are running around with covers on their face, screaming terrifying things. If you told us that's what you intended to do when you came to America, we would have never let you in. And if you do it once you get in, we're going to revoke it and kick you out.
Which is a pretty concise
He was very clear. That was about 2 minutes he used to explain what we just spent 20 minutes explaining. But that's why I love Marco.
That is why he's the Secretary of State. And we are not.
But I think, again, this outline, well, I'm watching it all unfold yesterday. And people in my comments trying to do like an own, I don't understand what free speech is. It outlined again to me like how imperative it is that we explain our rights, the enumerated rights of citizens as outlined by our Constitution, but that we also take a minute to research our laws before we sound off anywhere, because it doesn't matter if you don't like something. That doesn't make it a law. You cannot appreciate what's happening to Khalil. I don't know why you would want someone who has affection for terrorism, terrorist organizations in our country. But okay, if that's the hill you want to die on, fine. But just because you don't want him deported doesn't mean he isn't going to be deported based on the law of our land. You can't just say things and hope that they come true. That's just not how it works.
And there's another discussion that's happening about what does this do politically? Do you know what I mean? Well, you have the Democrats who are doubling down and supporting this movement or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Or they're trying to projected as freedom of speech and that it's an attack from a regime. Like a great.
That is fundamentally an ignorant response. It is uneducated about our law. And I am ashamed of politicians that are taking this and running with it.
Well, one of my favorites was Chris Murphy recently, who I did a full article on like how I think
you love that guy, right?
I was suspicious about that. I'm like, why is this guy popping up all over the place? Yep. I'm very suspicious of you. I don't trust you. Now his new girlfriend apparently is like a master Democrat strategist who I've researched in the past, who is like super sketchy. So anyways, I'm not going to go into it, but there's an article if you want to read it on my Substack. The point being, like, he just did a video that he posted where he used really inflammatory misrepresentations of him being disappeared. And this is what happens in regimes. And this is all about freedom of speech. And I mean, it was like 3 minutes. It was wild to
me. And he was dead serious?
He was, I mean, I just don't get. And my question is that what's the narrative that's going to win here? Is the narrative from the Democrats about this being an attack on freedom of speech, is that going to win? Or are normal people going to remember how in the past, quote unquote, protests and freedom of speech that was allowed to literally go out of control, which led to millions of dollars in damage in 2020 during the BLM riots, is what frankly some portions of them were. Mm-hmm. And then also what happened at the universities last year that caused a significant amount of damage. Is the Democrat Party going to be able to separate the normal person's mindset, especially the Jewish community and just like normal people, from them essentially, like you could say, by proxy, supporting that behavior.
They're being sympathetic to this guy. Is this who you want to hitch your horse to? Because
I just, like, I don't
go
know.
Go back 5 years. Did defund the police work for you? Because there was a whole bunch of defund the police during BLM in 2020, and everybody doubled down on that. And Kamala Harris and all these Democrats were like donating funds to get criminals out of jail who had destroyed people's businesses that they'd spent their life building. That wasn't a good look a couple years later. People don't have an appetite for that. They don't love that.
Yeah, I know. There's an argument right now going on where people are saying, oh, you're going to make a martyr out of him. You're going to create a movement behind him by, air quoting, persecuting him or going after him and by deporting him. But my thought is that that's just a very small, loud group. And if they continue to do what they're doing, which is causing property damage. Let's not even get into also what's happening. Not that this is specifically involving him, but the attacks on dealerships, people who own Teslas, and like all that kind of behavior is going to get lumped together. Yes. So I
think that the average American is going to look at this and they're going to cling on to like Marco Rubio, Secretary Rubio's 2-minute speech. Yeah, that seems pretty reasonable to me. I'm going to go with that guy. And I'm not going to go with this entitled, aged out college student who is a terrorist sympathizer. I think that most Americans are smarter than that. And they're going to understand that these limp-wristed, entitled college students who are all walking around during the day while everybody else is working their jobs and yelling that Khalil has free speech rights and this is an infringement of his rights and they have no understanding that he's not actually a citizen, I think that they're going to look at that and be like, oh my gosh, this is exhausting, these kids. And they're going to get that it is as simple as there's different laws for green card holders. You broke those laws. We have jurisdiction. You don't have to like it, but this is the federal government is able to say, no, we're going to revoke your card because you have links to terrorist groups.
Well, and that's currently where it stands. Who knows if this is something that could lead itself up further up the chain judicially? You know what I mean? Like,
well, and
I
get nervous for the protesting again. That's when I started watching those groups yesterday, and then like subsequent like riots that were happening in different state capitals about like ICE detention and illegal immigration and stuff. And I'm watching people, their anger is starting to get a little more heightened. I'm going, are we moving to like another summer?
Well,
2020?
And summer's coming. That's a thing. So the season is coming. So
let's pray it doesn't go there.
Yeah. So hold on to your pantalones because who knows what's going to happen. All right. Real quick, give you guys some information before we move on to our fun segment because we are running long today. I know a lot of people are getting whiplash with the tariff wars. Doug Ford threatened to cut the electricity to 3 northern states. He is the something of Ontario. I don't know. It's not the PM of Ontario.
I don't remember what it is, but then he walked it back.
Yeah, he walked it back. And so he talked to one of my favorites, Lutnick. And so he's supposed to be coming for...
I think it's so cute. We all have our favorites.
He is Ontario's
he's the premier. That's it.
There we go.
Yes.
He spoke with Lutnick, and so he backed down on cutting off the power. So they're still in discussions about that. However, the tariff war, quote unquote, or trade wars continue. I know it has a lot of people like stressed out. I think it has the market stressed out because they feel like that they can't plan. And I am also stressed out. I mean, Rachel and I have talked about, had discussions on the back channel, especially in regards to Canada. Like, what is the plan?
Why?
What is going on?
He needs to explain that quickly because it's not, there's no identifiable reason why we would be doing this to our closest neighbor, ally, exporter.
Not to this extent.
And they need to drop the whole 51st state thing. I'm tired of that. That's gotta go.
It was funny in the beginning because I appreciate control, but I'm like, I think we can move on from that. So not great. I'm with you, Rachel.
We've been
talking about this. Like, we're not loving this. We need to.
Not a huge fan of a couple things that are going down. Maybe we'll talk about those this weekend. I don't know.
Yeah, because we're doing. Oh, by the way, we haven't even talked about it. We're doing an unfiltered
episode.
Talk about
it at the end. Save it for the end so we can get them all amped up and ready.
Exactly. So anyways, but good news. Egg prices are down. Okay.
Woo-hoo!
There is a 5% drop since 2025, and which was like the height during the bird flu. So this declined 5.09% since the beginning of 2025.
Still high. Still not
still
great.
High, but trending down.
Gas How many chickens prices, do you have? How many chickens do you have?
I don't know. We had two that just, my hound killed two of them because the younger ones, they jumped the fence. But we're currently getting, like, they're starting to pick up production.
Yeah. Yeah,
and we're starting to average just over a dozen a week. And for the two of us, that's a lot.
Oh, see, we get like a dozen a day. So it's good. Get chickens, y'all. Even if you have to hide it from the HOA, just like,
dude, I'm a little,
you can do it. Just don't get a rooster. You'll be fine.
Well, or if you do end up with a rooster, because I did.
Rooster.
And I'm,
kill
well,
it.
I'm in city limits and we're not supposed to, don't tell anyone, but we're not supposed to have chickens. Okay. We're like guerrilla, like chickening over here, right?
What's a gorilla?
I can't say it in English. It's like gorilla. It's like guerrilla warriors, or when you're kind of like doing
Look at you, rebel. You're a rebel.
So we have chickens. We're not supposed to. One of our hens turned out to be a rooster.
Yeah.
And we found out when he started crowing. But our neighbors are actually totally cool with it. So we seem
just
to
go
fine.
Give him some eggs. They'll be
well, that's
fine.
What exactly. I bribe him with eggs, especially yep. now. Now yeah. it's like gold. Seriously. Like, I'm going to give you three
They're
eggs.
They're like, we it's love worth- you. They start buying you chickens for presents. It's fine.
Exactly.
It's fine.
And then other good news is that inflation is trending down. 2.8% in February of 2025, down from 3% in January. So small win.
Gas is down a little bit, which is good. Yeah.
Gas is down. Oh, and by the way, the EPA yesterday, I didn't even put this in the notes, but Zeldin yesterday announced a pretty significant amount of deregulation. It was like specifically, I think it was like 31 regulations. Nice. All of them, like what Biden had been doing that limited like coal production, energy production, forced EV production over gas vehicles, like all of these things that made energy more expensive. The EPA just recently pulled those regulations. It was like a total 31 regulations.
I know.
I like him. I know. And then finally, just so you guys know, not a big surprise because the conspiracy theory turns true. All of those numbers apparently where Biden was saying that I've increased arrests for illegal migrants crossing the border. So we all know the CBP One app was used for people that were within the country to go through a process to get paroled and get flown into the United States. So they were like here, quote, legally. Okay. I'm air quoting there. Now, the numbers of arrests, apparently, according to the acting ICE director, Todd Lyons, he recently told Fox News that the administration had been cooking the books in regards to these increased arrests that were happening, especially towards the end of his administration, because what was actually happening is that they were categorizing individuals that were being arrested were actually being processed and released into the interior. So if you were just like average illegal that was crossing the border, physically crossing the border, as opposed to using the CBP One app, they were counting those as arrests. And what in fact they were doing is that they were processing them and then releasing them into the United States. But then they were saying that, like, you would think, like, if you say arrested, you would think that you were arrested, detained, and deported back. And according to Lyons, that is not the case. The internal ICE review found tens of thousands of cases counted as arrests in late 2024. In November's 21,000, there were really catch and release and not actual detentions.
Great job.
Pay attention to that. Yeah. So all of this, well, he was increasing his arrests. Well, it doesn't look like it. It looks like they were cooking the books. And just to point out, I saw a graphic where the arrests that the Biden administration claimed to have made in 2024 was the same amount that Trump has done, like, in a month. Okay? So, yeah. All right. Let's go ahead and let's wrap
fun
it up
segment
for our
time.
Final segment.
Okay. So we have a good question. We have two questions, but let's just do one.
You pick it.
They're both good.
Close your eyes and point.
No, okay. What's a quirky habit or guilty pleasure you have, Masady, that most people don't know about?
What is a quirky habit or guilty pleasure? I will say a guilty pleasure of mine. This is actually kind of embarrassing, okay? And I don't do it often because
we won't judge you.
It's so trash.
We might judge you, but
I think it's really trash or whatever. Okay. But I'll watch Real Housewives on Bravo.
Yeah, I judge
especially
you for that,
older
for sure.
ones. I don't like the newer ones so far, but sometimes if I just really, really need to, and this
feel
is
better
so,
about yourself as a human,
it's not necessarily feel like I really just need to zone out, which is really kind of weird because there those like the drama I would argue
oh,
is
so elevated,
kind of like
toxic.
Stressful. But yeah. Like my default is politics or documentary or like I don't tend to be like we talked before, like I'm not a big escapist. But if I just need something really mind numbing where I'm just not thinking, I will watch Bravo.
I don't think you're alone in that. I think there's a lot of people who do that. It's because like, you can turn your brain off.
It is literally like something that I never do. And then I also feel guilty because sometimes I don't want to watch it when like because my husband will be like.
My husband would judge me for sure. Yes. I turned it on before and he's turned this off. This is trash. I'm not watching
this. And he judges me. I'm like, leave me alone. Just leave
just
me alone.
Just give me a minute.
And then like I'll also do it like my favorite like trash snack or just not good for you snack, which
right.
by the way, my house is an ingredient house. There's very few things that are purchased here that are like prepackaged. But I will go out and I will get a big bag of Sour Patch Kids.
Oh, okay. So you use sweets. You like sweets.
I like, well, just that one in particular. I like Sour Patch Kids and or gummies. And then I will watch Bravo.
Real Housewives. Okay.
Yes.
I think I don't have a whole lot of guilty pleasures because I don't find time for them. I don't know. But I'd have to say I am very curious about, morbidly curious about the mafia. I love anything that has to do with the mafia. I kind of think I would have made a great mob wife. I love movies, shows, documentaries, podcasts about the mafia. And not just
okay, so
not just the mafia
favorite,
in America.
Like all mafias.
Like the Chinese mafia, the Irish mafia. I really, in my mind, like mafia battles together. Like who would survive the different mafia battles? Like which nationality has
the serious...
You know,
I think
that
aligns with politics. If you think about it,
does.
That aligns...
Like, who would you be most more afraid of? Because like I'm married to, my husband is half Chinese. So I have a little insight there. Asian, like mafia, Asian, like those people can be crazy. Okay. But then you've got the Irish mafia who are just like, anyways, I really enjoy doing deep dives into the mafia.
Do you watch like mafia movies like Goodfellas, Casino?
Yeah.
That type
I mean,
of stuff?
Well, okay. And that's the other thing that's hard for me. The violence isn't what kills me about it.
Well, that's
it.
Why it's I'm asking.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. I struggle with fictionalized movies.
Yeah.
I tend to go more like, because I don't love all of the content. Like, I never watched The Sopranos, and everybody's like, what? You love the mafia and you don't watch The Sopranos? But I did, like, I think two episodes of it. And it was just, it was too much for me.
So I think, what is it? You like more like this, the strategy and the game.
Yeah.
It's almost like a house of cards kind
of
situation.
Well, I like learning about, like, I like reading about the mafia and actual, like, you know, mafia stories. And really intrigued with, like, New York in the 70s, the 60s and the 70s, and the mafioso, like, culture and mentality. So, yeah.
Do you
and
wanna
when
actually...
it comes-
It's funny that you bring that up because one thing that I have, which I think you might actually be surprised about, is that I have an almost bizarre and I don't know, especially as an American and then especially as a Puerto Rican, I know a ridiculous amount about the English monarchy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of
like going all the way back from the War of the Roses, especially
right.
Henry VIII, the Tudors. Yeah. Like, I'm fascinated by them. Mm-hmm. I've read all kinds of history. I watch all kinds of documentaries about it. Like,
no, I'm a big Anglophile.
But I wouldn't consider myself an Anglophile. I'm just like fascinated by the history of them. And also, it was like, I think it's also almost like Bravo adjacent, especially when you're talking about the Tudors.
Yeah.
Because of all the like,
oh yeah, they
marriages,
would make great
divorces,
yeah. It was
murders,
scandalous.
Like, you know, mm-hmm. Yeah, there's just a lot
there
of drama.
Is.
Like even with Mary Queen of Scots and
mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
and then Queen Elizabeth because she had
well,
like
I think
a boyfriend
too. We have such a young history, so it's fascinating when there's these other histories like of countries that go back thousands of years and everything's intertwined and there's drama and death and.
And cousins
and
hooking up and all kinds
of for sure. So, yeah, the mafia is like that for me. And if I have a guilty pleasure food, I said it the other day on Instagram. It's Cheez-Its. I could eat an entire box of Cheez-Its. And really? I love Cheez-Its with all my heart. My daughter is so sweet. She went to Costco with her dad a couple weeks ago, and there was like this Cheez-Its put out this new brand of like air chips that
I've seen them. Yeah,
and
they're like potted home.
Oh, rigid, not like not all I same. Want is the classic box of the little teeny squares. I'll eat the entire thing. My Instagram algorithm is always sending me like these earthy crunchy moms who are like, let's make our own Cheez-Its for our family with only two ingredients.
No.
I'm like, get that out of here. Get it out of here. I want all of the food dyes and preservatives in my Cheez-Its. That's what I want. And then I want to watch a movie about the mafia or read it, watch a documentary about the mafia. That's what I want. So yeah, there you go.
Well, it's all balanced. See, it's not all politics in news.
No, it's also the mafia and Bravo Housewives. So it's great.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and wrap us up for today's episode of Rivera and Reeves. If you have hung out with us this long on this extended episode, we thank you. Also, we are recording our next episode of Unfiltered this Saturday. We have no idea what we're going to talk about yet, because honestly, anything can happen.
Something will happen. Like, something will happen today or tomorrow. Don't worry about it.
Keep an eye out. If you want to listen to more Rivera and Reeves Unfiltered, I would recommend that you become a paying supporter. The link is in the show notes. That is an episode that is exclusive for our paying supporters. We are so grateful for your support. And if you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a 5-star rating, a review, share it with a friend. It really helps the podcast grow. And if you are new here, we are so grateful that you're here. Congratulations. You have discovered Junior Figure Podcast. All right, that's it. We are done for today's episode. And here's a reminder that the media is trash and we have no tolerance for it. Okay, deuces. Bye.
Bye.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.